Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to Question Reality.
Question Reality.
With Priscilla Leona.
Priscilla Leona.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Question Reality. I'm your host, Priscilla Leona, and we're coming to you live from Studio City, California. Our show is broadcast every Sunday from 5 p.m. to 5:50 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Now, if this is your first time tuning in, our show will help you question your career reality. This show is for you if you were, are, or might be considering a career in the entertainment industry. Our guests will provide you with advice and resource information on how and what it takes to successfully pursue a career in show business. Our guests work in various professions of entertainment, so that means that you will definitely have someone on the show sooner or later from a career that you're interested in. So you have to listen to every show. Now, if you want to check out our past guests, read their bios, listen to their interview instantly, or download one of the shows, you can do that by going to the LA Talk Radio website. And if you're listening to us now, you're already on it. LATalkRadio.com, and you click on the link at the top of the website that says Channel 1. You scroll down and look for the graphic of our show, which is Question Reality, and you click the link. And this will take you directly to our archive page where you can view the list of past guests. Our shows are also available for download on iTunes under the podcast section. You just type in Question Reality Radio. And I also believe we're going to be available on the Droid system. I'm not sure if we are already, and I missed that memo, or if that's going to be upcoming in the future. If you want to find out about future guests that are going to be on the show, you can visit the official Question Reality website directly, and that's questionreality.us. questionreality.us, not .com, .us for United States. Woo! Okay, now, today we have a very exciting and funny guest, even though he's not a stand-up comedian. He is funny enough to be a stand-up comedian. His name is Robert D. Steffen. He's an actor, musician, director, producer, and we're going to talk to him a little bit later and find out what the scoop is on Robert D. Steffen and why he's on our show today. But first, I want to talk to you about this new film consulting and mentoring site. Multiple award-winning producer Carrie David, she realized her longtime dream of mentoring filmmakers on a one-to-one basis by launching her new consulting website, which is carriedavid.com. That's K-E-R-R-Y, david.com. So this website is really going to hook you up if you are an actor who wants to start doing his own thing, producing his own film, directing his own stuff, and you don't really know too much about it. If you're a novice, a beginner, even if you're at an intermediate or advanced level, you still might have questions. So no matter where you are in the process of your film career, Carrie can offer you advice because she has a vast experience working in budgets. Whether your budget is $1,100, which she did for My Date with Drew, or a budget as high as $35 million plus, which she worked on for Agent Cody Banks, the whole franchise. So if you're considering filmmaking as an option and you're well into the filmmaking process already, having an expert at your fingertips is always a plus. So whatever the obstacles and challenges you encounter, from fundraising, casting, production, marketing, distribution, you should always have a consultant or someone who is experienced just waiting on the sidelines, an expert, so they can lighten the weight of the production. It'll really help you. So Carrie is available to help you in your choices and decision making. You want to check out her services and testimonials on her website. And again, that's carriedavid.com. Fantastic. Also, on November the 8th, we have, if you want to know, how do I finance my film? Where can I get money? My mother won't give me any money. My husband won't give me any money. I can't rob a bank. Where am I going to get money? You can go to the film finance panel that they're having at the American Film Market. The AmericanFilmMarket.com is the website you want to check out, and they will tell you how you can get funding from sources you never thought existed to get money to finance your own film. So you want to check that out on November the 8th. Go to the website, AmericanFilmMarket.com. Now we are going to find out about our guest today. Not only are we going to find out about him, but we are going to listen to a clip from one of his latest sound, a clip from his soundtrack a little bit later. First, we're going to find out about him. He was nominated for Best Male Vocalist in the 2008 Orange County Music Award, and his music is intimate, it's polyrhythmic, and it's melodically dynamic. So if you want to hear that, you're going to have to stay tuned to listen to his clip a little bit later. He's a native of Orange County, but he's traveled through Europe at the age of 20, and he moved to New York City at age 22, where for the past 10 years he was part of several award-winning avant-garde music and theater productions. Some of his credits include Public Theater's Othello with Liev Schreiber and Keith David, Jim Henson's Obie Award-winning production of the kabuki spoof Benton Kozo, and several NYTW Just Add Water developments. He's also appeared in independent films including Suicide Doors and Spike Lee's Bamboozled, and his recent film credits include the commercial Wine Picks for the new iPhone app, and Nicholas Toykin's grandfather of the author, yes, Nicholas Toykin, feature directorial debut, Anna Kappa. His character is Frank, who is a mystic sage and healer who masterminds the fate of the island visitors. That sounds very exciting and intriguing. We are going to hear, again, we're going to hear a cut from his latest album called One Song. And we're going to hear that about, I think, about 5:30. So stay tuned. And we are going to, without further ado, talk to Mr. Robert D. Steffen right now. Robert, are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
Oh, holy moly. Thank you so much for being on the show, spending your Sunday. I know a hot young guy like yourself would normally be out perusing the town, scamming for chicks, have the cocktails flowing, doing whatever you do at your age. And I thank you for taking part of your Sunday to join us and tell us all about Robert D. Steffen. What do you have to say about him? Let me ask you a question. Little Robert D. Steffen, what did he want to be when he was little? What, when he grew up, when he was little, when he wanted to grow up? You know what I mean.
Well, I think it definitely involved costumes. I used to get my grandmother's jewelry on when we go see my grandmother. And my brother and my sister and I would put on all of her earrings and all of her rings and sometimes her makeup and everything else, and come out and shock everybody because they thought we were playing, you know, Monopoly or something.
What? Wow. So those were the only costumes available in the house, that you didn't have any Halloween costumes you could jump in, huh?
Well, not on trips to grandma's. No, we had to make do with what we had, but it was a good time.
Well, it sounds fun. Did you ever get in trouble for that, or did your mother start worrying, or what transpired during these costume outlets?
I think it was all in good fun. There's certainly some family pictures still on file of those days, because I made sure to employ my siblings as well so as not to stand out too much.
Well, when you were in these costumes, what was going through your mind? Did you think, oh, you know, I want what do I want to be? And do I want to grow up and design costumes? Do I want to wear costumes? What exactly did you were you thinking about as a profession, or what did you think you wanted to do?
I think the thoughts at that time were BMX, how much can I get away with, and what could I get a reaction? How could I get a reaction?
Okay. Well, let me ask you, when did you start thinking about what you wanted to do as a career goal?
Well, I think our family used to watch a lot of movies together, and the more movies I watched, the more I felt like that looked like a good idea. I didn't know much about the business of it or the politics of it, but I thought if it's as easy as these people make it look, then it's got to be a good time. So, I mean, that started very, very early.
And when you were, did you want to be an actor? I mean, what struck a chord? Did you want to be, did you look and say, oh, that's a good time, I want to act, I want to direct, I want to produce? Did any of that kind of become clarified for you? Or did you just say, I want to be in the movie doing something?
I think I just want to be included. You know, I think I just want to be a part of it. And whether I'm the one holding the tickler or the camera or the costumes or, you know, the water bottles, I just wanted to be a part of it, you know?
Uh-huh. Now, so you went to high school. Tell us about your education. Did you pursue a career in, as far as go to film school? Did you take your career in the direction, your education in the direction of pursuing film?
No, I had acting teachers tell me I should be a director, which is kind of funny, because I think I just had a lot of ideas about things and was also not just interested in just being a focus of attention, but also, you know, how to tell a story and how to bring it to life and how to add color and texture and a lot of other things that weren't really things that a lot of actors were talking about that I was studying with, you know?
Where did you implement this that you were told by teachers? Did you work on school productions?
No, I didn't do any. Well, I played Santa Claus when I was about 8 years old, and you know, they gave me a pillow and to put in my vest, and that might have been the debut. But after that, I trained in New York pretty extensively and had studied the Meisner technique there with the teacher that was saying, you know, you should consider being a director. And at the time, I took that as kind of an insult, you know, because of how earnestly we were all pursuing our craft. But she was very wise and very perceptive, and I'm very grateful. And since then, I've been able to direct a music video and two short films and also some stage readings and hopefully some theater this year.
Okay, so when she told you that, did you take it almost like she was saying, well, you weren't a good actor, that you should direct because people who can't act direct? Or how were you insulted?
Well, I don't know if insult's the word, but it definitely it unnerved me because I was looking to this person for validation, which is something that I think a lot of young people do. They look to elders for validation, especially if they're teachers, and I was looking to this particular person to kind of, I don't know, you know, validate my innate talent or my creativity or these kinds of things. And when her comment was, you should be a director, I thought, well, that's different than what I was expecting to hear. And I didn't know what that meant. I mean, I think what it meant was just what she said. But at the time, it was kind of discouraging, actually.
Now, before you went to New York, you were 20 years old and you decided to go to Europe. Now, what was your inspiration for going to Europe?
Well, I think that Orange County is a pretty isolationist community. It's not even a community, actually. It's an isolated area, which is very, very interested in materialistic gain and kind of it's a kind of isolated place to live. There's a lot of wonderful things about it, but as I was getting older and I started to go to art house cinema and see movies like Smoke or Blue in the Face or even the movie Kids, I started to realize, oh my gosh, there's so much going on that I don't have a reference for, and I felt under-informed culturally. So there was a friend of mine, I was working, I guess I was about 20, and I was working at the Olive Garden restaurant making pasta for them. And a guy named Matt was on an international football team that would go and play in Paris. And he had a host family there that he would go every year for a season and play football. And I thought that sounds, I wasn't playing football at the time, but I thought, you know, that the idea of a host family is really intriguing. So I saved money for about 6 months and got a Eurail train ticket and just decided, you know, I'm just going to go and explore. And, you know, ignorance is bliss. I didn't know what I was doing. I just went for it.
And what happened when you got there? What do you feel that you learned, or do you feel it affected you, and how so?
Well, I think that curiosity is contagious, and what I found was that I didn't have any rules, really. I didn't have anyone, I didn't have a job or parents or teachers or any real authority figure to report to, and it felt very freeing and kind of overwhelming at the same time, because every two or three days, sometimes every day, I would get on the night train and go to the next country. And I saw so much in 5 weeks that it was almost a wash, but it was incredible. I mean, I would do it again in a heartbeat.
Oh, where did you stay? Did you stay at hostels or...
Yeah, I had a budgeted where I would stay either in hostels or share a hostel, or I would take the night train when I was low on money and sleep on the train and then arrive, you know, I would plan it where I knew the train ride was 8 hours or 10 hours, and I would sleep on the floor under the seats, and then when I arrived in the morning, I would just kind of get up and climb out, and the conductors were cool there. They didn't really make an issue out of it. And I wasn't, you know, making problems either, and I just kind of was friendly to people and wide-eyed and bushy-tailed, I guess.
Now, coming from Orange County, as your description described Orange County, and going to Europe and having to sleep on the floor of a train, did you find that you were, did you consider yourself roughing it? Was that like roughing it? And from that experience, did that actually teach you anything? Did you find did you become self-introspective and discover things about yourself that when you came back that helped you become more advanced spiritually, emotionally?
Well, I found out it's not a good idea to eat bread and cheese continually for 3 days in a row. I learned that if you stick with the Canadians, you're better off. I found that every time that I saw maple leaf on a backpack, generally they were people I could make jokes with and have fun with, whereas the Americans that I was that I interacted with over there, a lot of times tended to be kind of entitled and fairly loud on the trains and loud in the pubs. And I think they had a sense of, like I said, entitlement and expected people to cater to them. And so I tried to stay kind of undercover and try to get off the main road, you know?
And disguise yourself as a Canadian. You know, I've actually heard that story. I think I watched an episode of something on the Travel Channel, and one guy said that he actually disguised himself as Canadian because he was traveling in areas where Americans were not favored in the area. So he painted a red maple leaf on his backpack, and he also bought a Canadian T-shirt, and he was walking around Europe and people thought he was Canadian. And apparently Canadians have carte blanche wherever they go. Nobody wants to fight with Canadians. So if you ever want to disguise yourself, you can always say you're Canadian and get away with anything. You're going to be left alone. So for sure. My God. So when you came back, so you were only there 5 weeks, and you came back, and when you came back, you went right to New York City. You didn't even stop in Orange County. You went right to New York City. And how did that come to be that you decided, oh, I'm going to just go to New York City?
Well, it wasn't quite that quick of a turnaround, but I had wanted to go to New York on my way to Europe. I was hoping to find a flight from L.A. to New York, stay in New York for 3 days or a week, and then fly into Heathrow Airport. And it didn't work out. It cost quite a bit more, and it didn't line up the way I'd hoped because I flew on a standby ticket through my dad's friend, who was a pilot for TWA at the time. And everything was budget, budget, budget at that time, especially working, making pasta for the Olive Garden. So I had about, well, maybe a year or so, a year and a half that I was in Orange County and had ended up finding a new apartment and a new job and saving money again. And I just started to get restless. I took an acting for the camera class in college. I went to college at that point and was taking a lot of liberal classes, you know, philosophy and yoga and acting and things that didn't really add up on paper too much, but were interesting classes. And I realized, I think that I really should act, you know, I think I really should do this. And if I do, how can I be credible, you know? And I didn't see my own answer to that question wasn't necessarily moving to L.A., and lining up at cattle calls. It was going to, you know, move to New York City and study where the people that I looked to for excellence had studied, you know, either Circle in the Square or Actors Studio or the American Academy or whatever the alumni was that I was interested in. And, you know, I wanted to follow in the footsteps of what these people did that was, you know, risky and about struggle and dynamics and relationships and communication rather than looking good or being polished and commercial.
So when you got to New York, did you know anyone? Where did you find a place to stay? How did you survive?
I think a lot of it was by the seat of my pants and I think really good intentions. I was very naive and very idealistic and, mm-hmm. My aunt and uncle were sponsors of an organization called Uplift People at the time, and they had moved from Palos Verdes to Colorado. So I was talking to him about being an actor, and he said, well, if you really want to be an actor, you should do Uplift People. And I said, well, I don't know what that is. And he said, well, we're going to fly you out to Colorado to watch the dress rehearsal. And the politics were really, really cool. I mean, it was about understanding people, and it was about bridging gaps in between cultures and accepting other people and that kind of thing. But it seemed a little bit, a little too happy and a little too jazz hands for me. And I wanted something with a little more, you know, Shakespearean or tragic or a little more pathos involved. So at the time, I was sitting behind a guy that was going to school in Manhattan and was renting a room in Brooklyn. And we started talking, and I said, hey, do you think you know anybody with a room for rent? And I didn't know anything. I didn't know the proximity of Brooklyn to Manhattan or anything. I just knew that when I looked it up on MapQuest, it was 30 miles away, and I figured, well, I drive an hour to go to class, so it's fine. And I ended up renting a room in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, for 6 months and taking the subway to Madison Avenue to Penn Station every day. For acting class. And coming from Orange County, Anglo white bread, sliding into an Hasidic Jew in an African American neighborhood is quite the experience.
Yeah, I know exactly where you were. Being from Connecticut, I'm very familiar, you know, with where you were, and I'm thinking, wow. So you, you know, that really, I'm glad that you're saying this because you took a kind of a wide-eyed, bushy-tailed pioneer approach to your discovery, your path. I am one to say, before you go somewhere, always do your research, find out the area. I'm all about plan A, B, and C. So we definitely have two different dynamic styles of doing things, but I really appreciate you having that perspective and bringing that, because a lot of people might decide to do things the way that you do it, where you just go for it and kind of see what happens and live by the seat of your pants kind of thing. And I like that you're taking us on this journey. Now, from you being that way rather than being the planner and checking it out and doing all that, what were your trials and tribulations of doing it this route rather than being a planner and mapping everything out and saying, okay, well, this, I want to live here because this is in proximity to this and I want to go here and what were the trials and tribulations of doing it the way you did it?
Well, I think the hardest thing is that it's not accepted. It's not understood by other people. It makes a good story. I was reading Jack Kerouac at the time and some of the beat poets, and so I really wanted to experience that on my own terms. But it really belongs in books, and it really belongs in stories. As far as real life, a lot of people don't really understand that. They don't really sign up for that. So I think for, relating to elders, relating to older people, even in my own family that have taken a very, as you say, decisive and planned route, which makes a lot of sense, it's not always something you can really explain. I needed to do it. I had a lot of energy. I still do.
Right.
And mm-hmm. I wanted to jump and see if the net would appear kind of thing. And
Yeah, I said, yeah,
Well, in hindsight, I think I could have saved myself a lot of time by looking at which programs were the most recognized in the industry, be it Yale School of Drama, Circle in the Square, the New School, the Actors Studio, which piece of paper carries the most weight, because what I didn't understand was that just like in any other field, your colleagues and your credentials will at least get you, they're like a calling card going forward. Now, maybe you have all the talent in the world and maybe you're very easy to work with and everything else, but there's something about that, and that's why it's that way in the finance world, that's why it's that way in the church, that's why it's that way in a lot of subsects of our society, that people work with people that they know and people that are in their circle.
Yes, so it's called a clique, and it is ever present in every aspect of our life. And I still to this day don't understand why people don't understand that is part of the human dynamics. I don't understand why people say, oh, I don't want to be a part of that repertory theater because they're a clique, or I don't want cliques. They're in the office of an insurance company. They're in offices if you work at a law firm, Wall Street, entertainment. That is just the way it is. And I'm so glad that you brought that up, because people need to understand that you find the same directors and producers hiring the same people. Why? Is it because they're easy to work with? Is it because they get along with them? Is it because they started out together? Is it because there are many different reasons, but that is what you're going to find. And a lot of people decide they want to take the bohemian approach and kind of not be for. There's one actor, I know you probably know who I'm referring to, famous actor, A-list actor. He refuses to be part of the networking and the Hollywood parties. He didn't even have a phone for the longest time. His agent would have to trek out to his home in Montana to actually bring him scripts. But still, he was cast for A-list projects. So what is it about him that he cannot hang out with Steven Spielberg the way Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg were together? You know, what is it about him that he can still get projects and that are A-list projects like Tom Hanks, because Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg are still friends? What's your thought on that?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head pretty well. I used to have a feeling that I was compromising something by trying to change how I was around certain people. You know, I felt like what's important as an actor is to have some personal integrity and to be to be truthful, to be a sincere person, regardless of who you're around. But you're absolutely right. You know, in the world of corporate affairs and the world of any kind of industry, really, there's always going to be politics because it's the nature of people. And I saved myself a lot of heartbreak once I decided that I can save a lot of energy by not having to agree or justify or defend or even decide things with other people. And sometimes, more than anything, it's what's required. You know, you look at a lot of very successful actors, and I think that they are able to be what is required. So if what's required is something very subtle, they're willing to be that. If someone needs them to be a movie star to promote a project to get publicity and get some momentum behind it, they're willing to be that. And then if it's really not about the actor at all, and it's really a technical concern of having the crew get, you know, certain angles and certain establishing footage, and it's about the producer, and it's about, you know, City Hall getting a permit to shoot overseas or whatever it is, then that same actor, if they're willing to be what's required, then they would just keep their mouth shut and read a book. Then, of course, they're going to keep working because they understand that they're serving the work, you know, they're being what's required.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, a question, when you were in New York, you obviously, you've done theater and you like film, so my question is, which one do you like better?
Well, it's kind of like, do you like guitar or drums better? I mean, I play both in their...
Everybody always has a favorite, no matter what they say, and even if you don't have one now, as you pursue your career down the road, you will make a decision. So maybe right now you can't decide, huh?
Can't decide.
Okay, but you will decide. You will. Usually people who get started in theater, their heart always stays with theater. Film, they always stay with film. But you should always have a balance of both. You know, some people say the best actors are theatrically trained. Film people say that they're too overly dramatic. There's always somebody going to be saying something about something. So the quicker you learn that everybody has an opinion and you can't really let yourself be swayed by that, you just have to rejection comments. Everybody's going to have something to say about you, no matter who you are. Somebody's going to think you're weird. Somebody's going to think that you're dramatic. Somebody's going to think something about you. So the way you should look at it is, when they're talking about you, they're leaving somebody else alone. That's the way I look at it. So let's go back to you're in New York, you're doing theater. Did you really enjoy doing, for example, you did the Kabuki spoof, Benton Kozo. How did you like that? That's something that, wow, you know, that's like a five-act play there. Did they turn it into more, did they Americanize it more, or did they stick traditionally with the Japanese style?
Well, Jim Simpson was influenced a lot by traditional Kabuki and a lot of Japanese films, and what he did that I think was recognized and appreciated by a lot of people is he made it palatable for a sophisticated New York audience, and then he made it fun and funny and entertaining, where he kind of took the archetypes that were present in traditional Kabuki and made them more more animated and silly. So we had dramatic elements, but also we had a live band, a rock band that played on the stage while doing the production. We had a trap where there was a walkway above the seats in the house. And one of the characters, the word for tea in Japanese is dozo, and one of the characters would run from the far corner of the house on this catwalk above the audience, screaming dozo, just holding the O, just going, Dah! And then when she got to the stage, zo, and would stop and offer tea. And it was, you know, stuff like that was a blast. I would still be doing it if there was a paycheck involved, you know?
That sounds like fun. Yeah, that's perfect for a young guy. That sounds like it's got all the elements of excitement there for sure. Now, let me ask you something. I want to find out what your feelings are about creating value out of your performance or product, the experience of it. How do you feel that you can get the best value out of your performance?
Well, that's going to come down to why you do it. And, you know, mm-hmm. going back to the Benton Kozo thing, there were a lot of women in the cast, too. And so he would cast some of them as males, which was a lot of fun. And, you know, with something like that, you don't have to pay. Well, it's easy for people to do that for the fun of it. And you can get a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm and really committed performances because it was so much fun. So, I think adding value kind of goes back to what I was saying about, being what's required, being malleable, being easy to work with and collaborate and have something become, or being willing to allow a project to be a process. You know, sometimes people get into, like you were talking about planning A, B, and C, and that's very important. But some people can get so interested and so bound to what the plan is that they're not able to see the possibility. And so, for example, when we were working on Anna Kappa, the script that we started with, the working script, is nothing like the movie at all. It was a story, and there were ideas in it, and there were relationships in it. But once we started to flesh it out and rehearse it and actually work on location in the mountains of Santa Maria and work on the beach in Summerland and work in this old cabin that had been abandoned, the elements really informed sensorially what was happening in the film that I haven't seen it. I'm excited about seeing it because it's nothing like the script, you know. We got way into the process, and it was a lot of fun. And so there's a lot of value in that.
What does the term make it mean to you, to make it in the industry, entertainment industry?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know what that means. I think that, there are people that are in a position to hire a publicist, and they're able to be seen with high-profile females having lunch in a nice eatery in L.A. or be dating them, and then that makes a good blurb in Entertainment Magazine or People or something, and so then that appears to be success. And then you have someone else who's carrying a $100 million film, and it's their name and likeness on that media junket, and so they may have made it. And then there's also people that, there's a director in particular I have in mind, who he directs and writes and edits and does everything himself, and he's profited on every film he's done, and he calls the shots. And I think he's made it too. And so lastly, I would think making it is exactly what the words imply. You make it. You make the opportunity. You make the possibility. You make the relationships. You make the investment, and you make the connection. You make the connection with people you work with, and you make the investment in the work, and you make the possibility by,
I understand what you're saying. You know, you just create it yourself. Whatever your individual choices are, that is what you're going to make it or break it for yourself. I understand that for sure. Let me ask you a question. Do you feel that, looking back in retrospect, do you feel that the choices that you made and the route that you took, the approach that you took to pursue your career, was the right approach for you? And if so, what do you feel that you did right? And what do you feel that if you had a chance to do over, you would change?
Well, I'll answer that in a second. How many actors does it take to change a light bulb?
I have no idea.
One to hold the bulb, and the rest of the world just revolves around them.
Ah, I love it.
You like it? Okay. Now, to answer your question, I think kind of what I touched on before, I think if I had everything to do over again, I would have researched what producers and casting directors and directors, what training do they look at? Where do they go to discover new talent? And who do they see as the best programs? Is it Yale? Is it ART? Is it Circle in the Square? Is it, you know, where are they looking and where are they drawing? And then where are the actors whose work I'm admiring? Where are they training? Where are they coming from? And I wish I had researched that a little more carefully before dropping a whole lot of money on training. But the path that I took, I can say, was entirely my own choices. And I'm grateful for that. And I wouldn't change any of that for sure.
Because so we do have a little bit of you kind of coming over to my side with the planning. You do feel that your advice to young people starting out would be that they should do a little bit of research to find out where they need to go. Is that what you're saying?
Well, absolutely, and I do agree with you. Where are you going to be able to go and train, where you can work with directors, where you can work with writers, and where you can collaborate from the beginning? Because I think if you isolate actors and you say this is, you know, prestigious actor training, that's not very realistic, because actors should be collaborators. They should be open to what writers are doing. They should be open to what directors are doing, and they should understand the language of film and the language of other art forms, because it all feeds into the creative medium of creating a character or creating a story. And those are the funnest actors to work with, and the funnest actors to have dinner with are the ones that are interested in the world around us, not ones that are isolated and interested in the profundity of, you know, the craft of make-believe.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself, Robert D. Steffen. Now, we have a couple minutes here, and I want to just briefly touch on the fact that you also are a musician. You are in maybe, I don't know if it's one band or several, but we do have a song called One Song that we're going to hear. Now, did you just tell us briefly about that? We have about 7 minutes. Let's talk about, did you write it? Did you tell us about One Song? Do you write music? Do you have a CD? Do you have a band? Just give us all your music information.
Well, I've got about 25 original songs, and they all kind of change depending on the venue and performance. So I'll play solo at wine bars on the Central Coast, or you know, I'm playing at a wedding in September, that kind of thing. And then I'll also play with a band. We just opened for Eastern Conference Champions, who were on the Twilight soundtrack, in Redondo Beach at the Brixton. And in that case, it was electric guitar with, you know, really nice tones, a little bit of delay, a little bit of chorus, a little distortion to beef up the sound, because it was a trio, and that was a rock show. So I love all kinds of music, and I like to kind of feel what people are interested in coming to. I mean, some people want to come and hear music and they want to be moved, but they want to also have a conversation and drink a glass of wine and relax. And so that's a different setting than going and having your ears bleed and having, you know, it just rock your heart chakra with the low end, you know. And, you know, so I have a whole roster of people that I play with in different circumstances, and going to the One Song, a very, very good friend of mine wrote the melody and the song mostly, and he came to me with the lyrics. He's like, I want to hear what you can do with this vocally, and I don't know which version you have. I don't know if you have the first one or the second one, but
I have the first one because you didn't send the second one, so I only have the first one. Yeah, you said there was going to be some edits and you'd send it to me, but I guess, you know, you forgot or something happened. So I just have the first one. Now, would you say that what type of music do you play? R&B, blues, jazz, soul, rock, everything?
I think that when the album's done, I think I'm going to call it Pawn Shop Elegance. And I think that describes the style of music, because if you go to a really good pawn shop or a really good thrift store, you can find stuff of quality has a certain warmth to it that may not be recognized by a lot of people. And the music that I do goes from kind of dark, gothic sounding music to also very light, folky sounds to almost droning music with like tribal percussion and stuff. And I think it's just hearing the muse, it's hearing the ideas, and then allowing them to be played. And then what you can do is say, well, I'm going to put this one aside, or I'm going to play with this one more, or I'm going to put this one on an album or not. And we're in the process of working on writing for an album right now, my friend Jack and I.
Oh, that's fantastic. Where can we as an audience find out more about Robert D. Steffens? Give us your website addresses.
MySpace.
We can find you on MySpace. Robert, is it Robert Steffen Music?
Exactly.
Okay. And I know you're on YouTube, but if we type Robert Steffen, are you going to come up, or are you under Brel Cousteau?
I'm under Brel Cousteau, and I should explain that, because Jacques Brel was a big influence for me. I like his music very much and his lyrics. And then growing up, we would watch Jacques Cousteau, The Underwater Adventures of Jacques Cousteau. And so I thought, well, Jacques Brel, Jacques Cousteau, I'm going to call my name Brel Cousteau. And I didn't give it any more thought than that. So that's the username on YouTube. And that has clips from the independent film Suicide Doors. It has some student films I did in New York, and it has clips from various iPhone performances around the Central Coast.
So if you want to check Robert Steffen out, you want to go to YouTube.com and type in Brel, BrelCoustau, BrelCoustau. You might want to add Robert D. Steffens in the keyword so people can find you, because people might get confused. Branding, pick a name, stick to it so everybody can find you and know where you are. IMDb.com, Robert D. Steffen, you can check out his credits. And right now we are going to play his song, one song by Robert D. Steffen. If you want to find out where he is, get on his mailing list. I would imagine they can do that on MySpace. They can send you an email. Is that right? How can they get on your mailing list so that they can come see you perform?
Yeah, absolutely. You can send an email on MySpace, and then ReverbNation.com has a button where you say join the mailing list. But I haven't been checking that much lately. I've been so busy with, I wrote and directed a short film recently called Protons to Picasso. That is a Santa Barbara film with Santa Barbara talent and Santa Barbara storylines. So a lot of time has been consumed with that. But on MySpace, you can send a note, or ReverbNation.com. It's a lot of information, but you can ReverbNation.com, Robert Steffen Music. You can join there. But I'd love to hear from people and hear what people have to say.
All right, Everett, we're going to close it out with one song. Thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate you contacting me, being on the show. Feel free to come back next year and let us know what you're doing. Contact me. We'll have you back on the show and play more of your songs, okay? Let's keep up with your career, all right?
Sounds fun.
Okay, here's one song by Robert D. Steffen. We're going to close the show out. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Song. You gotta sing it before you die.
You're listening to Question Reality. Question Reality. With Priscilla Leona. Only on LA Talk Radio.